This class is going to be a diverse one because I simply haven't had time to sit down and collect my thoughts and prepare anything, but I've been involved in something. But I'm going to, first of all, share with you what I've been involved in. And that is on the in today's Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, on the front page, there is an article, and it's entitled, Rabbinical Court Had Role in Deal for Property. And what happened here is that the city of Pittsburgh is building up a new shopping center. And a student of mine named Richard Penzer owns some of the property, most of the property, actually. And he was involved with negotiations with the city. And at one point, he agreed to a certain price, and this was several months ago. There were a lot of considerations, very complex deal, but he wanted to due to certain things that he felt weren't fair and various other problems, he wanted to simply withdraw from the deal. So there's a whole big question, according to Talmudic law, whether he could do that. It's not so simple. Legally, he would have easily been able to do it. He wasn't bound legally by American law. But being a student of the yeshiva and an Orthodox Jew, he's bound by Torah law. So it was a very involved situation, and we went to a rabbinical court, and the court is in Brooklyn, and it is an excellent court, and they decided. And as the paper records it, it says, they say, the three rabbis dressed in suits and ties heard testimony in a library filled with volumes of the Talmud, the ancient rabbinic writings that enable today's rabbis to interpret Judaic law. And they said the rabbis listened to the complex Pittsburgh real estate case for about 3 hours. I was there. It's pretty accurate. It's true. And then they deliberated for about 45 minutes afterwards without Richard Penzer in the room. And their ruling was that Penzer should sell to the city at the price that was discussed at a meeting about 8 months ago. Established that. He's another student in the yeshiva, by the way. He works for Richard. And this was, as I said, on the front page of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And it is really a sanctification of God's name. I mean, the whole city, you have no idea. I mean, this is like one of the biggest deals, $78 million deal that's going on in the city of Pittsburgh. And it was held up, and it was resurrected because of the rabbinical court. So I've been very involved in this, going down to the court and the discussions, and it's a very complex situation. But the good thing about the Torah system is that in order to be a rabbi, one must study all the areas of the Talmud that deal with very complicated financial matters, such as mortgages and loans and the most complex situations, real estate situations and other financial situations, extremely difficult laws. I mean, just to comprehend them on the surface is very difficult. It takes a lot of intellectual work. So a rabbi is really has to be a very highly intelligent individual, and he can understand, the most complex business deal, legal, all the legalities, and they don't have any problems. So it was discussed for 3 hours, and then they deliberated. And basically, according to Halacha, once you shake hands on a deal, that's it. You can't change your mind. The idea of, in the Torah law, it's called kinyan. And this is something, by the way, that it's important for Bnei Noach to know as well, because this is, all these laws are pertinent to Bnei Noach. I mean, it strikes me as so strange when people say that, well, you only have seven laws. I mean, that one law, this would come under the law of stealing, of course. If you have to know when property is transferred. Stealing involves ownership. Transference of property is a very complex situation in halacha, and there are several tractates devoted to it. It's, people, the science of Torah, the science of Talmud is simply an unknown science in today's world. But people just don't know what kind of depth and theoretical understanding there is in these matters. But one of the laws, just to put it very simply, is that if you shake hands, that's a deal. You can't. If you remember if anyone remembers the Book of Ruth, do you remember how that deal was consummated? By taking off the shoestring. Okay, now that's a whole halachic institution as well. It doesn't have to be a shoestring. It could be any. You can consummate a deal with any garment. In other words, a lot of times when I consummate a deal, I could just, you know, I take off my yarmulke and give it to the person, and that will consummate the deal. So there are several acts that can be used in order to consummate the deal. But if you remember in the Book of Ruth, what it says there is that this is the way it was done in Israel. And that when we would take off the shoe, a man would take off the shoe and give it to his friend. So you could use a shoe, or you could use any kind of an article that is considered a complete article. Okay, you can consummate a deal with a needle. Of course, even though it has no monetary value. But the Torah recognizes two types of value. There's economic value in terms of monetary value, and then there's value, utility value, according to Torah. So you can consummate a deal with an object that has utility value, like a shoe in the case of Ruth, or a needle, or anything. And that's a method of consummating the deal. But another thing, if you look carefully at the verse in Ruth, you'll see it says that this is the way it was done in Israel. Which gives us insight into another halacha, and that is, if you live in a place where a deal is done in a certain manner, that also becomes effective. And that's where the handshake comes from, because the handshake is used often used to indicate consummation of a deal. So if the country, the custom of the country here, plays a role in halacha, that is, if the custom of the country is to consummate a deal through a handshake, then that becomes effective and binding, and you can't change your mind. It's interesting. In this case, there was a handshake given, but what happened was that originally, this is a combination of the city of Pittsburgh is involved in this, and also Federated Department Stores, Lazarus from Federated Department Stores. And originally, Federated was supposed to buy the property. But what happened, and that's where the handshake took place at that meeting. But then the city decided they're going to buy it out, and then they're going to deal with Lazarus Federated. So that becomes another halachic twist over here, because once you do that, now you've changed the parties who you've agreed to with on the deal. So I may be bound to do a deal with a Federated, but now if the city, Federated is working with the city, and the city decides that they're going to do the deal, I'm not bound anymore because the party has changed. That was one of the complications in this case. Halacha is very precise and very exact. And the Beis Din sat down for 3 hours and listened to every single detail that they felt was important according to halacha, and asked questions, and they came to a decision. And this, in effect, affected the entire city of Pittsburgh in terms of this project, which is a multi-million-dollar project, and it was brought to a standstill. Until the rabbinical court decided that Mr. Penza cannot change his mind at this point. It's interesting, according to halacha, there are two systems. There's the ethical system, and then there's the legal system. If you don't do a handshake, you can change your mind. But ethically, once you give your word, your sound word, your final word, talk according to halacha is not legally binding. Speaking is not legally binding. But the Talmud states that on an ethical plane, if you give your word, you shouldn't change. You're not allowed to change. You really should not change. If you go to a Beis Din and you did change, the Beis Din cannot force you to consummate the deal that you obligated yourself to do, but simultaneously they will tell you that this is not the most proper way to act. One is not supposed to change from one's word, provided the word was a final word. The words during negotiations don't count at all, because those are final words. Those are just negotiations between the parties. So there's always, and the halachic system is always two different systems. One is the technical, legally binding phenomenon, and there's many, many, you know, volumes on that. But then there's also that really is the most complex area, although every area is theoretical. Because the question is, what is a word? But there's a famous story from the Talmud. The Talmud says that the highest level of an individual is not even to change from what they thought in their heart. And the Talmud says that there was a scholar, his name was Rabbi Safra, and he was selling an article to a Gentile. And the Gentile knew he wanted to sell the article, and he knew what the price was, and he approached Rabbi Safra, and Rabbi Safra was in the middle of reciting the Shema. And he was reciting it quietly. The Gentile didn't realize. So the Gentile said to him, I'll give you, let's say, $10 for it. So he didn't answer because he was in the middle of prayer. So then the Gentile said, okay, I'll give you 12. And he didn't answer again because he was praying. Then he said, okay, I'll give you 15. So he still didn't answer. Finally, Rabbi Safra finished with his prayer. And he told the Gentile, he said, I'll sell it to you, but at the first price, because when I heard the first price, I conceded. I wanted to sell it at that price, and I am not going to take one penny more. So the Talmud says that is an individual who truly fears God and who loves truth. So it says the verse I believe is from Psalms, who speaks truth in his heart. So that's what the Talmud says. That's what that means. That if in his heart he made a decision, he will not go back. He will not back off of that. And, the Talmud always says that the fear, that's an example of the fear of God. The fear of God is always in something that is not demonstrable. Anything that people could see you do is suspect, because people do it because they know others see them do it, and it's a religious act, and they look very righteous. But the Talmud says the real fear of God is demonstrated in the person's heart, where only God knows that he is doing something, and his family doesn't know, and no one knows, and he does it simply because that is the truth. In other words, there is no ego satisfaction. The moment other people know about it, then there's ego satisfaction. Then, of course, it could be, it does not mean necessarily that the person isn't being sincere, but the real test is when only God knows. So that's the case of Rabbi Safra. But of course, that's considered an extremely high level of an individual, a very high level of function. It is not mandatory, and it is not even something which the average person is obligated to do. It is just like a height of perfection that a person should realize, should understand, and should aim for. So that's not something which a Beis Din will discuss, because there you're simply talking about heights of perfection. It's outside the realm of the Beis Din, which deals with law on a practical level. But nevertheless, it's something that a person should know. And I would like to, if I may, just elaborate a little more, because somebody asked me a question, has to do with the same thing. Somebody wrote me a letter. It's an excellent letter, and David also got the letter. And the title of the letter is "Am I a Noachite Too?" And the person wrote in the letter. He says the planes are. You're gonna have to pardon me. These planes are just rooted in the wrong way at the wrong time. Okay. So the person writes as follows. I'll just read to you what they write. They say Noachism is Gentile monotheism. It is not a religion. It does not advocate a religious life or obligatory worship. Of the seven, the only laws that could be construed as having to do with religious practice are, in fact, prohibitions against pagan activities, idolatry, blasphemy, eating the limb of a living animal. The call to a religious life and ritual practice is conversion. Judaism is religion. Noachism is the enjoining of mankind to rational behavior and the creation of nations authorized by God through the Jews who, with their special obligations, chosenness, Torah, and history, are the light through which God has revealed his plan to all of us on Sinai. Okay, now I would like to just elaborate on that point. You see, where it says that Noachism is not a religion, but Judaism is, and only conversion can bring a person into the religious life and ritual practice, I would like to clarify something about that. And that's something which, again, is commonly misunderstood. You see, one must understand what Judaism is, what Torah is. If it is a religion, is it not a religion? This has always remained unclear. I would like to, if I may, I think it's important. I want to get back to the major. After this week, we're going to go back to the Talmud and to the seven continuation of study of the seven laws in Sanhedrin. But as you know, I mean, in the Torah is the same way. The best way to study is to follow a natural order. Sometimes you have to break away from the given order in order to take up some important points. So digression is really a part of Torah study. It's not really digression. It's simply following those things which are most important at the time, in terms of the people that are involved in the learning. So this I think is extremely important, and it should be defined properly. You see, the question is, what do we mean by religion? Okay, and some people say, well, Noachism is a philosophy, or Judaism is a philosophy. How would we distinguish between a philosophy and religion? I mean, why can't we call every religion a philosophy? Okay. What would be the distinguishing feature? You know, we often use words, and they have like vague kind of meanings. And that's one thing which the Talmud does, is the Talmud teaches a person to be very precise in their definitions. Every word has to ring clear in the mind with a very being related to a very specific idea. Vagueness is something which the Talmud abhors. The Talmud would rather say, I don't know, than to be vague. So I would like to, if I may, clarify the difference between philosophy and religion, what it means precisely. You may disagree with me, but I'm going to present my view of the matter. In religion, you see, religious practice, what people call religious practice means involvement. There must be some kind of, as this fellow writes, I agree with him on this point, he says ritual activity. Now, his problem is, in Noachism, there's no ritual activity. It's negation. In other words, you cannot practice pagan rituals. So his argument is, well, this is negation, but you're not doing anything. Where is the doing? Okay? I want to explain what doing means in Torah and what doing means in religion. I maintain Torah is not a religion. Judaism is not a religion as well, not just Noachism. I'll explain to you what I mean. In religion, a ritual in religion is an activity where the person who indulges in that activity believes that this activity itself conveys some special... causes some special effect in his soul, in his relationship to his God, in his fate, and it's going to affect him, which means the performance itself has some kind of value. And that's why they maintain, or the belief, believe in this and you are saved, okay? Do this and your soul is made holy. Okay, that is religion. Religion always means that a certain ritual, a certain practice is going to be the magic that's going to do it for you. In some way, it's going to save you, give you a place in the world to come, change your life, make you prosperous. It's going to do something. Take away some kind of a curse, give you some kind of a blessing, okay? The ritual activity is going to do the trick, okay? In Torah, there's no such thing. And I can prove there's no such thing not just from so many sources of Talmud and interpretations, but simply from showing what Noachism is in relationship to Judaism. Okay? Now, in Torah we have performances, and what this writer refers to as ritual practice, but we don't have ritual. I would not call it ritual practice. I mean, there is no word for halacha in English. There's no word for it, because halacha is not ritual practice. Halacha does not mean that this activity is going to do the magic that's going to save you. That's not what it means. If you take, for instance, circumcision, okay? Circumcision is, I would say, if you want to talk about something which people would call a ritual practice, what could be more than that in terms of Judaism? B'nai B'rith, I mean, even people that aren't religious do it, okay? But the Torah does not believe that that is the action that's going to save your soul. It's not. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned before, in the case of, and the Talmud states clearly, in the case of hemophilia, there is no circumcision, and the person is not considered inferior in any way. There are certain halachic restrictions. I mean, that's true. He may not be able to eat from the Paschal lamb, but that's not because he's inferior. You see, that's a mistake that people just don't understand the halachic system. The person who is uncircumcised because it is dangerous for him to be circumcised can be the greatest, most respected individual in the world, and he could be on the Sanhedrin, and even though he may have this certain restrictions, but the halachic restriction has nothing to do with the value of the person. Okay, he's not considered inferior. He's not considered in terms of the fact that he's not circumcised doesn't take away from his place in the world to come, not one iota. As a matter of fact, if he would circumcise himself, then he would be in violation, because one is not allowed to jeopardize one's life for circumcision. Okay? So there you have, and that's why I've mentioned many times, you kind of philosophize halacha. There may be restrictions on the Paschal lamb, but that's because of the nature of the that's God's wisdom in terms of the nature of the Paschal lamb. It's nothing, it's a halachic idea. It has nothing to do with the value of the individual. And the halacha absolutely prohibits such a for a person to even try to circumcise himself if there's any danger of to his life. So the Torah system has activities, halachic activities, which perfect a person. In if a person studies the commandments, as the Torah says, knows the commandments, understands the commandments, keeps the commandments perfect them because not because of any magic in the performance. And that's why the Torah is not just doing the commandment, but it is understanding the commandment. When the children of Israel said at Sinai, they say, "We will do and we will hear," which doesn't make any sense, of course. If you have to hear first, what it means is do. You must hear, of course, first, then do, and then listen and understand. It doesn't mean hear, it means to understand. Because the understanding is the most important thing, because that really is what captures the essence of man, his intellect, his mind, his understanding. And that's why the understanding is even more important. You know, there's a Jerusalem Talmud that says that understanding the commandments is one piece of understanding of the commandments is worth more than all the performances that a person can do in their lifetime. It doesn't mean a person shouldn't do performances. Don't get me wrong. Performances perfect an individual on a different level. But what reaches the soul of an individual is the knowledge and the understanding. That is really the essence. The Talmud says that in the world to come, and I mean, if it means if, you know, if the person, if you give that term, world to come can mean two things. It could even mean the messianic era, or it could mean post-mortem. It means life after death. In the life after death situation, there are no commandments anymore, because that's when the soul has reached the state of perfection. And the only thing that the activity of the soul then is purely knowledge. Okay? So the commandments are vehicles of perfection. And the performance of the commandments are vehicles of perfection, and the understanding it is even a greater vehicle of perfection than the performance. Okay? But all the commandments of the Torah are not religious, because by religious, if you look at religions, you will always see that the belief that the action has some kind of magic that's going to affect the individual in some way. That is not the concept of Torah. That's why the Torah is a totally rational system. The most important commandment, if it endangers personal life, you're not allowed to do it, not permitted to. It would be a major violation. Because the important thing is the person should live and gain knowledge and be able to keep the Torah. So there are only three exceptions, of course, when it comes to idolatry or certain sexual prohibitions and also taking another one's life. That's something else, because that's the sanctification of God's name. But even if a person didn't give his life in those instances, he would not be a person that deserves not to live. He just failed to sanctify God's name, which is wrong, but it's not considered as if he actually, he's not to be put to death or anything. But getting back to this concept, that is, I would say that the Torah is not a religion either, because religion means, again, certain practices are going to affect you just because of the nature of the practice. Now, in the Torah, all the practices, all the commandments are vehicles of perfection. They're vehicles of perfection. Now, the Torah, the proof that Maimonides brings is straight from the Bible itself. Because what does the Bible say when it speaks about Moses, when God gives Moses the greatest praise? So God says, and the man Moses was more humble than any other human being on the face of the earth. So Maimonides says, humility is considered the virtue of virtues. Because humility means where a person recognizes, in truth, what he is in the scheme of the universe and God. Now, that's a very difficult thing for a person to do. It's a frightening thing for a person to do. Most people, if they do that, would not be happy. Only a very great person can do that, because a very great person has very little interest in the self. As a person becomes greater, the interest is supposed to be, his energies, his psychological energies, are supposed to be directed outwards, not inward. In other words, the great person is one who is really involved in seeing the greatness of God and in his wisdom in the universe and his wisdom in the Torah. And the self is not really that important, not really concerned about the self. So such a person can reflect, as Abraham said, and I am just dust and ashes. That is considered the highest level. Moses was even a higher level than Abraham. But the highest quality, the greatest virtue is humility. So Maimonides says, so you see from that God praises Moses, where the highest adulation that God gives Moses is that he is humble, which shows you that the purpose of all the commandments are to reach that state of perfection. And therefore, Maimonides says, that a Gentile can reach the greatest perfection, even though he is not bound and even by the commandments. You see, now here is where here's another point I'd like to make with regard to the letter of the individual, and that is that the Ben Noach can perfect himself through those same vehicles that the Ben Israel uses. So you cannot say that that Noachism is devoid of any kind of practice. That is not true. He first of all he's obligated, as I said, and he can involve himself. And it is advised that he should involve himself in the study, at least of the basic study of the seven laws, which is a very complex study in itself. And the more knowledge he has of that, the higher he is. As the Talmud says, a Ben Noach that spends his life steeped in the seven laws, studying the seven laws, is considered as great as a high priest. I mean, in other words, a high priest is considered one of the most him and the king are the two most respected positions in the whole system. So, and the high priest represents it's the highest position in the whole religious system. So, and the high priest is supposed to be a great scholar. There were times, unfortunately, when that wasn't the case. But really, in the perfect system, high priest is supposed to be one of the greatest scholars in the world. So, the Ben Noach can be as great as the high priest if he spends his life in the study of the Torah and its laws.
Rabbi Don tells me it's time to turn you off.
So, in conclusion, my point is the following. The mitzvos, the commandments of the Torah, are not rituals, they are vehicles of perfection. They're vehicles for the Ben Israel, vehicles for the Ben Noach. Is that a religion? No. It is a method of perfection that's given by God. The Ben Israel cannot say, I am not going to do any of these. He's obligated to do so. The Ben Noach has the ability. It's voluntary on his behalf. He can do it, does not have to do it. But the difference is much slighter than what people think. And that's my response to the question, is Noachism a religion, or is Judaism a religion? And the answer is that there's no magic here. It's truly perfection of the personality. I would like to bring a further proof of this by simply throwing out a question. How many of you would like to receive a curse? Now, I don't think too many people would enjoy that. Yet, if you take a look at Deuteronomy, you'll see where it says that where the Torah says, and hold on one second, just give me one second here. The Torah says, this is Deuteronomy 11, all right? It says, behold, I'm giving before you today a blessing and a curse. And then it says what the blessing is. The blessing is to listen to the commandments. And it says the curse, by the way, this verse is the verse which shows that the entire Torah is the uprooting of the most primitive notions and ideas. That's in Deuteronomy 11:28. The curse is, if you will not listen to the commandments of God, and you will turn away from the road which I am commanding you today to go after other gods, which you do not know. So that's the whole Torah, is a tirade against idolatry. Now, it says over here, and when you come to the land, it says in 11:29, you will give the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Evil. All right? And it says they are, and tells you where they are. Now, the Torah picks this theme up again in Deuteronomy 27, all right, where it says that Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, keep the commandment. It says, in the day that you pass over the Jordan, you should set up stones, okay, and cement them. And then it says you should write on the stones the words of this Torah when you cross over the land, in order that you should come to the land that God gives you, etc., etc. Now, that's the setting up of the stones and the building of an altar, okay? A very special, by the way, the Torah says there's a special requirement for the altar. It shouldn't be like a pagan kind of altar. So that's expressed in the verses that follow. Now, it says in verse 8, it says you should write the Torah on these stones very clearly, okay? The rabbis say that means in 70 languages. I'm going to get back to that in a moment. Then it says, now take a look at a little further, it says, these are the ones that shall stand to bless the people, and it says, it gives the tribes, Simon, Levi, Judah, that's in 27:12, and it says, and these ones shall stand for the curse, okay? And these ends, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali. Okay, so you have the tribes broken up. Now, if you have to be careful. I'm not going to go into the technicalities of the verses, but the verses, what they mean, if you read them carefully, read Rashi, explains how it works. But what the verses mean is, how it took place, you have to make recourse to the oral law. Because at first sight, it would seem like these should stand to bless the people, and it gives you the tribes, and then it says, the others will stand on the curse. So, and then it says the ones that give the that make the statements are the Levites. It's a little confusing. The Talmud explains how it worked. There were two mountains, Gerizim and Evil. Six tribes went up to Gerizim. Six tribes went up to Evil. And I'm wondering if the word evil is came from that word Evil. But at any rate, the Levites stood on the bottom. And when they gave the blessing, what they did was they faced the tribes on Mount Gerizim. All right. When they gave the curse, they faced the tribes that were on Mount Evil. All right. And it was the exact same sentences were used for the curse and for the blessing, except when it was a blessing, it says, "Blessed shall be the man who," for instance, the first one has to do with idolatry. So the blessed shall be the man who refrains from, etc., etc. And then it'll, then when they face the other way, when they face the Mount Abel, they said, cursed be the man who does idolatry, okay? It was done in both positive and negative. All those statements that are mentioned in Deuteronomy 27:15 straight through to the end of 27, okay? Now, if you'd ask a religious person, well, how would you like to stand on the mountain where the curses are recited to? They'd say, well, please. As a matter of fact, due to the fact that we are among the nations and primitivism seeps into all different areas, there are people that will not, you know, when you get called up to the Torah on the Sabbath, there are people that will not get called up to the Torah when the curses are read. There are two portions in the Torah where you read the curses. Now, there are some people that will not get up and take that portion of the Torah because they're superstitious, think it's a bad thing. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik, my rabbi, used to go out of his way to take that portion in order to show people that that is totally nonsensical. But obviously, you see this in the Torah itself, because why should six tribes receive a curse? I mean, that would be, in terms of your superstitious, you know, superstition, and in terms of general religious ideas, you would say, hey, that's a terrible thing. But you see, the Torah is anti-superstition, anti-mystical, and the Torah says, no, there's nothing wrong with this, for the very simple reason. There's an idea here that the Torah is teaching us. It's an important idea. The important idea is that the Torah insists that we know not just good, but evil. That we know not just what a blessing is, but what a curse is. You cannot know one without the other. A good physician, Plato, by the way, made this observation as well. We have to give him credit also for his intellect. And Plato said, a physician is the man who knows how to save a person, but he's also the best man who knows how to kill a person. Because knowledge of how to save someone, ipso facto, by definition, gives you knowledge of how to kill them. And the same thing is true with knowledge of Torah. And now the Torah insists that we study the good, but it also insists that we study evil, because you cannot know one without the other. And that's why the Torah has a story of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's why the Torah has a story of the flood. The Torah is a story of a pharaoh. It's a study in evil and a study in good. The Torah demands that we understand both. So those tribes that stood on Mount Ebal, this was not a bad thing. There's nothing in the Torah is bad. To be the ones that the Levites faced when they gave the curse, it wasn't giving a curse, a superstition, some magical kind of activity that's going to affect them. This was knowledge. What they were teaching the people was, if this is what you do, then you're going to totally deteriorate and you're going to lose everything that you have as a human being. And on the other hand, if you abstain from that, you do the following, then you're going to partake of human greatness. And so with every single statement of the Torah that's mentioned in Deuteronomy, in that chapter, 27:15 on. That is the Torah concept. Not a superstitious, primitive, mystical idea, but a very intelligent idea. It's interesting that, you see, when they came into the land, they had to do two things. They had to write on the stones, the Torah on the stones, and they also had to have the verbal expression of the blessing and the curse, which essentially involved keeping the Torah. The last one mentions keeping the entire Torah. And the other ones were certain specific things were singled out as being very outstanding in terms of the Torah's philosophy and the Torah's understanding. So you see, now what was that concept? The concept was that the land of Israel had to be tied to ideas of Torah. It has no value. That's why the Torah says, the land will spit you out if you don't keep the Torah. Because this land is not a nationalistic conquest. This is not nationalism. As Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, Zionism is not a part of my vocabulary. The vocabulary of the Torah person is Torah and keeping God's commandments. And that's why Joshua, when he took the people into the land, had to write it on the stones to show that this land is only a land of Torah. That's when the people have a right to be in that land. If they keep the 613, then never. As a matter of fact, some of the question is what was written on those stones. You know, we don't know. We weren't there. We don't know exactly how it was done. To write the entire Torah on all the stones is a bit difficult. One of the great interpreters says that it means that the 613 commandments were just written on the stone. You know, each commandment was written down. We don't know. But the point is, the idea is the same. The concept is that this land itself must be tied to Torah. And that's why there are many laws in the Torah that are specifically tied to the land. The land is a more halachic kind of phenomena than any other land because of the fact that there are certain commandments that are specific for the land. This is to give a person an awareness when they walk in the land of the importance of a life that is a life of Torah and a life of halacha. And the second thing that had to be done was it had to be done verbally as well. You see, every means was employed here. The entire Deuteronomy is that this land is tied to the commands, the God's commandments, and that's why it was done verbally through the curse and the blessing, and it was done in writing as well on the land itself, which is the stones of the land. It's an interesting point here, you know, and that is when it says that it had to be written Ba'er Hetev, which means expressed clearly. So the rabbis of the Talmud state that this means in 70 languages. Okay, again, I don't know how that was done. If that meant if that meant literally 70 languages, or if only some languages are used for some parts and other parts to convey the idea of 70 languages. I mean, you know, we can guess, but it really is pure speculation. But the idea is true, and that is that the Torah is not just for the Jewish people. The 70 languages means that it is for the entire world to see and to know. So, of course, the question comes to mind when the Septuagint was written, as you know, within the Ptolemaic dynasty, and the Septuagint, the translation of the 70, and when that was written, the fast day was declared by the rabbis. So the question is, why should a fast day be declared if the Torah itself says that it must be expressed on the stones in 70 languages, which means there must be anybody that sees, walks by and sees those stones knows that this is, the entire world should know about the Torah. So why were the rabbis so depressed, so upset that when they translated the Torah into Greek, that they declared a fast day? I think the answer is to be found in the very statement of the rabbis, because the rabbis say that there were certain changes that were made by the 70, and the changes were made because the people who the scholars who translated it knew the philosophy of the people very well, and they knew that they aren't going to accept certain interpretations. Certain things are going to bother them. It's interesting. One of the things that they changed was had to do with feminism. Really, today it reminds me of today's society. They changed the verse that says that Sarah laughed in her heart. If you remember, when she was told that she's going to have a child, it says Sarah laughed in her heart. So they changed that word to mean laughed with her relatives in Hebrew. Why? Because they said that the people will say the Torah is not fair, because Abraham left and he didn't get punished, and Sarah was reprimanded for it. So I say the Torah is a society that is unfair. And so apparently there was a feminist movement even at that time. That was one of the things that changed. It's interesting to see what they changed. Of course, they changed anything in the Torah that there was an implication of. That anyone can say that there is more than one God, that they changed as well, because they knew they wouldn't accept the interpretation of the scholars. And there's several things they changed. It's interesting. But my point is, why was that declared a fast day when the Torah actually seems to demand, according to the rabbinical interpretation, demands that this Torah must be Torah declared for everyone? I think the difference is as follows. The difference is that In the time of the Septuagint, when they were instructed to translate the Bible, the instruction was done not because they really wanted sincerely to learn, but it was done out of curiosity, And they wanted to pass judgment on the Torah. Whether, is this Bible, what is this Bible? We heard so much about it. Let's take a look at it and let's see if we like it or not, you know, or what it contains. That is not good. You see, that's not good. That's why they declared a fast day. It's not a good, if a person is going to make themselves the determinant of what Torah means and what it stands for, that's bad. That's like modern Bible critics and various Christianity, other systems. But if the people that want to understand the interpretation of Torah are willing to listen to the interpretation of the scholars who have the inside information on how to interpret the Torah from Sinai, then it's a blessing and it's a wonderful thing, and it's, as a matter of fact, something which should be done and must be done. The Torah demands that it be done. But there must be the acceptance of the methods of understanding the Torah. If the scholarship and the knowledge is going to be denied, and the person is going to say, well, I'm going to use my own my own mind to determine what the scholarship of Torah is, then it's tragic. I mean, it's tragic. It would be just as tragic as a person who would be let loose with medications is going to determine what's the best thing for them to take and has no knowledge of what to take. So the Torah is a system that demands the recognition of scholarship, of Torah scholars and scholarship. Then it's a wonderful thing. With the Septuagint, that wasn't the case. They really wanted to pass judgment themselves. But getting back to my other point, and that is that you see from the case of giving the curse that the beauty of the Torah is the knowledge and the understanding, and I think that's what I've been trying to say the past few weeks, and the modern mystics are really going back to a primitive kind of thing, which is really against what the whole Torah, what the entire Torah stands for. Are there any questions?
No, I think you answered all of them. No, you did well. I read, and I can't recall where you're talking about writing the Torah on the stones.
Yes.
Somewhere I read that one of the scholars said they wrote the 10 words of the
Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments.
Yes, that's a possibility also.
Yeah, that's within the Ten Commandments are the entire 613.
That is definitely a possibility.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard the other, as you said, it's almost insane to think they wrote every word of the Torah on the stones.
Right.
Okay. All right, we appreciate it. I appreciate your time, and try to rest and stay out of the newspapers.
Okay.
All right, we'll speak later.
Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.